Hare Krishna. Welcome to the Bhakti Shastri course. We are discussing Nectar of Instruction. We have completed one class in which we discussed the preface of Nectar of Instruction, and we also had an overview of the flow of the contents of the Nectar of Instruction. Today we'll start with the first verse of Nectar of Instruction. So let's begin. Vacho vegam, manasah krodha vegam, jivha vegam, udaropastha vegam. Etan vegan yo vishahet adhiraha, sarvam upimam prithivim sashishyat. So, vacho vegam, manasah krodha vegam. So, here Rupa Goswami starts by talking about an interesting concept called vega. So, vega, what does it mean? The word vega means urgency. In Sanskrit, the word, in vernacular languages like Hindi, Marathi, the word vega often means speed. So vega, Prabhupada translates urge, that means that there is desire and there is urge. The difference between a desire and a urge is that a urge is something which is urgent, which makes us want to act immediately, which demands that it be fulfilled at once. A desire is something which is there. We want to do it, but we may have a desire to maybe see the Himalayas or see the Niagara Falls. We may have a desire to go and see the seven wonders of the world. Many kinds of desires we may have. They are more like idle desires, daydreams. But urge means when that comes, we have to do it. It's urgent. That is the very meaning of the word urge. Vega. Vega is a little vegavan. Vegavan is speed. So when that urge comes, when the vega comes, it's a very speedy demand. It has to be fulfilled. So this is what he's talking about. Vacho vegam. So he's talking about six kinds of urges over here. That means these are the desires that when they come, they demand they be fulfilled immediately. So there are the urges of the speech, vacho, manasa, krodha, vegam. So here, for the sake of rhyme and for the sake of structure, Rupa Goswami merges the word manasa and krodha and uses the common vegam for them. And he does the same for udaropastha. So he's talking about the urges of the mind, the urges of anger, then jivha, the urges of the tongue. Now, the tongue urges, he classifies as the urge to eat. Where the vacho vegam, he talks about the urge to speak. So when the tongue is speaking, it is acting as a jnanendriya. When the tongue wants to eat, it is acting as a When it is eating, it is acting as a jnanendriya. We take in food through it. We taste food. We come to know about food through it. Whereas when we speak, speech is a way by which we get work done. So, vacho refers to the karmendriya function of the tongue. And jivha refers to the, jivha vega refers to the jnanendriya function of the tongue. So, then udar upastha vegam. Udar refers to the belly. The stomach has an urge to eat a lot, and upastha refers to the genitals. They have a desire to enjoy also. Etan vegan yo vishahet dhiraha. These urges, the person who tolerates, one who is able to sahan, to tolerate them. Vishahet dhiraha. So such a person, sarvam apimam prithivim sashishyat. Such a person is qualified to be a teacher of everyone in the world. Such a person is capable of taking disciples all over the world. That means the capacity to control the senses enables a person to gain one qualification that is important for becoming a guru. A sober person who can tolerate the urge to speak, the mind's demands, the actions of anger and the urges of the tongue, belly and genitals is qualified to make disciples all over the world. Now this may raise a question that this book is starting with Updesh Amrit, that is the title. So it's starting with Updesh for the disciples. So how does it start by talking about the qualifications for a guru? Is it asking that the disciple has, that the seeker is becoming, going to become a guru? And why should it, for a seeker, it talk about the qualifications of a guru? There are multiple understandings. The first is that the seeker begins by finding a guru. The seeker has to know the qualifications of a guru. The guru is one who has conquered all these urges. Now, of course, the guru has both regulative and positive qualifications. So the regulative qualifications are described over here in terms of the capacity to control and conquer the body and the mind. Along with that, there are also the positive qualifications in terms of the attachment to Krishna. And that will be described in later verses when Rupa Goswami talks about the levels of devotees and the exalted devotee who sees Krishna everywhere and who is serving Krishna one-pointedly. But here, at one level, it talks about how a disciple should see the qualifications in a guru. At another level, it recognizes that even the seeker has to aspire to become a seer. Even the seeker should know these are the qualifications that eventually I have to acquire. And so, by spelling out those qualifications right in the beginning, the clear mindset is created. This is the direction in which I have to go. There is much more which I have to do when I go in this direction, but this is important. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught exemplary devotion, but he also taught devotion that was coupled with detachment and renunciation, because he himself was a sannyasi and the six Goswamis were sannyasis, and even his grahastha disciples were not attached. They were attached to Krishna, not to the world. So the detachment from the world and the capability to control the urges of the body and the mind that make us attached to the world, that is an important qualification of a bhakta. So this qualification is what a seeker should also aspire to develop. And in that sense, this positioning of the sarvam apimam prathadim sashishyat, the positioning of this verse right at the beginning of the act of instruction, indicates the direction in which Rupa Goswami is going to lead us. So he will start first by talking about how one needs to control the negative side of bhakti, negative side of our own life on the path of bhakti. And then it will talk about how we will be able to nourish the positive side. And through this progression, the Upadeshamrita will guide us towards prema. Actually, Prabhupada's purport begins in a very interesting way. He seems to start a little abruptly, but we see the depth of Srila Prabhupada's thought here. Without giving any prologue or that this is a question, this isn't giving an introduction, an act of instruction. It's already done under the preface. Prabhupada comes directly to the point. And his point is also very deep. He says, yes, we all want to control the senses if you want to make spiritual advancement. But how can one do that? What is it that makes a person have uncontrolled senses? And what can help the person to control the senses? So he immediately goes to the conversation of Shukadev Goswami and Parikshit Maharaj in the 6th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the first chapter, where Shukadev Goswami is asked by Parikshit Maharaj, how can people give up sinful activities? So the context is that in the previous canto, the hellish sufferings are described. Parikshit Maharaj, being a compassionate person, he had been a responsible king, concerned about the well-being of his citizens. So both as a responsible administrator and as a compassionate Vaishnava, he is concerned about the plight of those who are destined to suffer in hell. He asks, how can they be delivered? And then, it says, those who have committed sins, as a reaction to that, they have to suffer. But if they commit atonement, they can escape the suffering. So, Shukadev Goswami speaks this as the first level answer. Generally speaking, the sages see the level of the questioner and answer accordingly. And sometimes they give multiple levels of answers where the answer moves deeper and deeper and deeper as one becomes more perceptive. So this is the first level answer that Shukadeva Goswami gives. In the Chandogya Upanishad, there is a conversation. How many Kati Devaha? How many gods are there? So the figure moves forward. First they say, so many hundreds of gods, then less, then three, then two, and finally one. So the idea is, as people thinking evolve, they understand that there cannot be multiplicity of gods, there is ultimately only one god. So this is how the teacher also raises the level of understanding of the student. So when he starts by describing that do atonement. Then Parikshit Maharaj has been a king and he has seen how when criminals are put in jail as a punishment, that punishment in and of itself doesn't reform the criminal so thoroughly. They often come out of the jail and they commit crimes again. In fact, many times in the jail, they get contaminated by even worse association. And therefore, there they commit even greater sins. So therefore, what is the way out? The way out is not simply atonement. So now, prison punishment is not exactly an atonement, but basically it is a way in which a person is given consequences for the misdeeds by the king. So those consequences can come voluntarily also. When a person does atonement, that means, oh, I have done this wrong and I want to atone for this. This is what I will do. So scriptures describe atonement, but he says that that doesn't work. I have seen that imposing punishment, whether done by the state or done by oneself, doesn't work. And he gives the example that this is just like elephant being bathed. Prabhupada gives two more examples of Christians going for confession and a thief being punished. So now of some religious people go for confession, and when they after they do confession, then they come back and say that again I am going to do sin. And again they will go and do confession. So that sort of confession is not much use. Sometimes they say, okay, I have done this sin, please give me confession, and next week I am going to do the sin again. So please give me advance confession for that. Now advance confession makes a mockery of the whole process of confession. When we make confession, the idea is that I am not going to commit sin again. So if somebody does advance confession, that means that person has no intention of reformation at all. And then that is definitely a mockery of confession. So this sort of confession doesn't work. And what is the solution? So therefore he says, just like an elephant may bathe, but then elephant comes on and puts dust on it, own body. So then that sort of atonement is of no use. So similarly, he says, this is of no use. Then Parikshit Maharaj goes forward and asks deeper. Sukadeva Goswami answers deeper and he says, you can do vimarshanam. You can absorb oneself in the cultivation of knowledge. He says, even that is not enough. Because even when there is knowledge, still that does not lead to purification. See, atonement doesn't work because one has not lost the sinful mentality. Sinful mentality is still there and that will make a person do wrong things again. And he says, even if a person acquires knowledge and understands, I am not the body, I am the soul, still the suffering doesn't go away because one still thinks that I am independent of God, I am Atma on the path of Gyan. One doesn't really connect with God and get a higher taste. So he gives the example that when a liquor pot is washed, still the smell of liquor remains. Like that, even if a person is cleansed, some sinful reaction still remains, some sinful contamination remains, and the person is attracted to sin again. And then finally he says the way out is by the practice of devotional service. So let's look at this quickly. So Maharaj Parikshit asks a question about atonement, and explaining the futility of atonement, Srila Prabhupada talks about these three analogies: the elephant bathing, the thief and the police, and the confessions. And then Prabhupada moves forward to the developed description of real atonement that is talked about by Parikshit Maharaj. So this involves the awakening of our dormant Krishna consciousness. And this is training according to regular principles and methodical life. So we'll discuss this one by one. What this means is that how do we reform ourselves completely? Now, to reform ourselves, we have to revive our original nature. We are originally pure, we have become contaminated now. Now, without returning to our original pure nature, if we try to decontaminate ourselves, then we just shift from one kind of impurity to another kind of impurity. From the impurity of passion and ignorance to the impurity of goodness. And that doesn't really restore us to our original nature, and we can always be dragged down again. Because we are just shifting from one unnatural state to another for the Atma. So when we return back to our natural state of loving and serving Krishna, then we actually become purified. And then we attain a purity eventually, that is the purity beyond return. We attain a point where we will not fall back again. So what all does it involve? Srila Prabhupada explains that there are two ways to do it. So the training according to regular principles and methodical life, in that when I want to do real atonement, I'm sorry, I will not do this again. That's the idea. So one has training according to regular principles and methodical life. What all does the training involve? It involves traditional tapasya. So in tapasya, tapasa brahmacharyena shamena cha damena cha. So it's a long verse which Shukadeva Goswami describes. Prabhupada would quote this first part, tapasa brahmacharyena. So one does austerity, and Prabhupada would give the example of austerity as fasting on Ekadashis. Brahmacharyena. So the practice of celibacy. Celibacy, yes, does not mean renouncing family life. Celibacy means, it can also mean practicing householder life also according to the principles of dharma. So now, tapsa brahmacharena shamena chidamena cha, then mind and sense controlled. So what is mind and sense control actually? It's an interesting concept when you talk about mind and sense control. Often we put the two of them together, but it's not necessarily together. Actually, mind control is safer and better than sense control. Although, in one sense, it's tougher also. But, in another sense, it makes things easier. Shamena cha, damena cha. Actually, Shama and Dama are considered to be characteristics of a Brahmana. Shamo damastapa cha usham, shantirarjavayama cha, jnanam vijnanam astikyam, brahma karma sabhavajam. Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita described in the 18th chapter the qualities of a Brahmana. So therein he describes the Shama and Dama. And this is also described by Shukadeva Goswami over here. So Shama is mind control, Dama is sense control. So the idea is, it's always better to control the mind itself. So if the mind itself doesn't go to wrong thoughts, then the senses will not get stimulated, and then there's no trouble of controlling the senses, because the senses are not gone out of control, then they don't need to control them. It's like, if I know I am in this room and I have got a precious jewel in this room, and I know that just outside this room, outside the door, there is a thief who is waiting to pounce in, take the jewel and go off and run away with it. So what will I do? Now I'll lock the door, bolt the door, chain the door and never open the door. Make sure that the thief doesn't come in. So like that, the room is like our consciousness. In our consciousness, we have the jewel of Krishna. And outside the door, there is the thief of Maya. And Maya is waiting to come and steal away our Krishna consciousness. Tuck. Waiting to bounce in and pounce on the jewel and take it away. Now what should we do? We should not let Maya come in only. That means, we busy ourselves in Krishna consciousness so much that we lock the door for Maya. That there's no way she can come in. When we keep ourselves absorbed in Krishna, then the door gets locked. That is mind control. That means we don't let the mind, locking the door means we don't let the mind go entertain the thoughts of sense gratification only. That is not so easy. We can try it. Definitely it's much safer if we can do it. And we'll be happier also because we'll be absorbed in Krishna. But when we can't do that, that means somehow we'll leave the door open. And as soon as the door is in a little crack open, thief bangs on the door and throws it open and then charges it. So at that time, what do we do? Oh, now the thief has come, let him take the jewel and go out. What can I do? No. At that time, what do we do is, we jump on the door and then we try to force the door shut. We fight the thief and push the thief out and then lock the door again. Now, the struggle involved in fighting back the thief and closing the door is much greater than in just keeping the door locked. Similarly, the struggle involved in fighting off the agitation after the mind has got agitated and the senses have got stimulated, after that struggle is much greater. That means we leave the door open, thoughts about sense gratification come in. After thoughts come in, then we become agitated. And I say, no, I'm not going to indulge in this. And then the senses have got become hungry now because they have tasted blood. It's like when a tiger tastes blood, and a tiger restraining the tiger becomes difficult. Similarly, the senses taste, oh, there is pleasure available over here. Senses, they're like tigers. When they taste blood, then restraining them becomes difficult. But then the fight will be much greater. However, we can fight. It's not just because we have become agitated, we have to succumb to the agitation. Just because the door has been left open, a thief has come, it doesn't mean that the jewel has to be stolen. We can push the thief out and lock the door. Similarly, when the mind gets agitated, then the desires come in and they shake up our consciousness. They're coming, Maya is coming to steal away Krishna from us. We can push Maya, we can chant, we can. The mind is agitated, but we don't let the agitation express itself at a sensory level. We don't act sinfully. We may desire, sinful desires may come in, but they don't transform into sinful actions. So that is sense control. So mind control is better. First is Shama. If Shama doesn't work, at least do Dhamma. Then beyond that, there is Tyagena Satya Chaucha Abhyan Yamena Niyamena Va. So Tapasa Brahmacharina, austere celibacy. Shamena Cha Dhamena Cha Tyagena Satya Chaucha Abhyam. Renunciation, Satya, truthfulness, Chaucha Abhyam, cleanliness, and Yamena Niyamena Va, by the practice of the rules and regulations of the process of yoga. By all this, what happens? By all this, one gradually becomes purified. This is the traditional method of tapasya that is talked about in the Vedic literature. And it is important. As devotees also, we can follow this, can follow some principles. But our focus is not on following these principles. Our focus is on purifying our hearts through the direct engagement of devotional service. Now if you see, in all these, the focus is not on Krishna. The focus is on self-restraint. Focuses on self-mastery, which is good. It can become a good platform for practicing Krishna consciousness. But in and of itself, even celibacy is not spiritual or devotional. There are so many, there are times, if even atheists can also be a celibate. It's difficult, but atheists can be a celibate. So celibacy in and of itself is not spiritual. When we say a brahmachari is not just a celibate. A brahmachari is a person who is trying to do charan in Brahma. One is trying to live in Brahman, is pursuing Brahman. So these are material. These are helpful because they set up a platform by which you can practice bhakti steadily and swiftly. At the same time, what this verse recommends, this is a gradual, this traditional tapasya is a gradual process. In contrast with that, we can have the pancharatrik tapasya. The pancharatrik tapasya is what Rupa Goswami did. Now, what is Pancharatra? Pancharatra is the method centered on devotional activities. So, there is the Pancharatrik Vidhi and it centers on taking shelter of Krishna and practicing devotional service in a way that is centered on the worship of the deities and the service to the spiritual master. So when we practice devotional service in this way, at that time, by such practice, we make swifter spiritual advancement. So there is Rupa Goswami telling us do's and don'ts. And what are the do's and don'ts that he tells? The do's are practice bhakti under guidance of Guru in the association of devotees. Tandera Charana Sevi Bhaktan Sinavas Janame Janame Ho Yehi Abhilash. So, my desire is Tandera Charana Sevi. I want to serve your lotus feet of my spiritual master. And how do I want to serve? Bhakta Sanivas, by living in the association of devotees. Janame Janame Ho Yehi Abhilash. This is my aspiration, life after life. This is the mood of a devotee. This is what we should do. And purification is guaranteed if we do this. Serve the spiritual master in the association of devotees. And the don'ts are, we follow the four regulative principles. You don't indulge in sinful, immoral, anti-devotional activities. So among these two, the devotional processes are far more potent. And that's why they are far more important. And in the path of bhakti, the celib, tapasa, brahmacharya, shamena, they are important, but they are not all important. And sometimes a person may be a brahmachari, but that person may not be necessarily as devotionally disposed. The person who is not a brahmachari, person is grihastha, but has a greater devotion. So the important point is that renunciation, self-control, truthfulness, all these are conducive for the practice of bhakti, and that's why we adopt them. And to the extent they are conducive, to that extent we utilize them. And when they can become obstructive instead of being conducive, then we reject them. That's why we have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu making the famous verse saying that, Naham vipro nachinarpatir, na vivaishyo na shudro, naham varani nachagrahapatir vanastho yatirva, kintu prodhyan nikhil paramananda purnamritabde, gopi bharto padakamalayor dasa dasanudasa. So he is saying that he is disidentifying himself, distancing himself from all the four varanas and the four ashramas. Although Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is in a very privileged position both ways. Among the four varanas, the brahmana is the highest. Among the four ashramas, sannyasi is the highest. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is a brahmana and a sannyasi. So he is in the most privileged position in the varana ashram, and he is still distancing himself from both. He is saying, oh, I am none of these. And what am I? I am simply the servant of the Lord of the Gopis. And that Lord is the reservoir of all joy. He is the greatest source of happiness. So, as sadhakas, we do need to practice the traditional tapasya to the extent it helps us in the process of devotional service. Now, how do we apply this? So, now Srila Prabhupada is going to talk about it. So, we have to practice tapasya, and when we apply the principle of tapasya, applying the principle of tapasya is to do vacho vegam manasaha krodha vegam. So let us look at the application here. The application is based on Srila Prabhupada's purport and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's purport. So Srila Prabhupada himself quotes Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur's purport in the second part of his purport. So let's look at first at Srila Prabhupada's purports. So Prabhupada talks about vacho vegam manasaha vegam krodha vegam. Then he talks about jivva and udarapastha briefly. And then we will go to Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur. Now what is vacho vegam? The urge to speak. So Srila Prabhupada gives the example of karmis and jnanis who are speaking things which are unconnected with Krishna. And by such speaking, they are simply inviting the snake to come and devour the toad. This is a graphic example given from nature. The Bhagavatam uses many analogies drawn from nature to illustrate its many profound principles. So when we are in this world, we are tempted to speak many things. Ayur harati vaipumsam udyan astam chayanita tasyarte yachanoni uttam shlokamartha. That person who is not engaged in glorifying the Supreme Lord, for that person, with every rising and setting of the sun, life is diminishing. The person is dying with every passing day. So what do we do? When we engage in Brajalva, it is just as when a toad speaks, toad is croaking, then the snake cannot stand tall and see where the toad is. So it's a little difficult for the snake to find the toad, but when the toad speaks, that sound basically attracts the snake. Okay, the toad is here, let me go and eat it. So, similarly, it is said that when we speak unnecessarily, we attract the snake of death. Now, we wonder, how does this happen? Some of us may feel that, okay, there is destiny and our lifespan is fixed. If our lifespan is fixed, then it's not exactly a lifespan. It's the number of breaths that we are going to take that is fixed. Then at that time we are going to die. Is it that if I speak more, I am going to die faster? What exactly does this example convey? It's not that time is going to grow faster. It's not that death necessarily is going to come closer. But the point is that the flow of time is relative to the way we engage it. So if we engage ourselves in frivolous activities, and often frivolous activities just consume our time so much that we don't realize it only. And we don't, sometimes we get into prajalva and so much time just goes away in that. Just chit-chatting. And actually we see in many ways, most newspapers, most chat rooms and things like that, they are basically often filled with prachalpa. So this sort of prachalpa is undesirable. We'll discuss more about prachalpa, but here we're talking about vacho vegam, the urge to speak. So often when we speak, we get so absorbed in it that time just flies away and we don't realize it also. This was both Pururava's realization and Yayati's realization. He said, when we got into sense gratification, then just how time went away, I didn't realize only. So that's what happens to people. Sometimes people start watching TV and one program, second program, third program, and just time flows away. So the important point is that actually we will waste so much time without realizing how much time we have wasted. So that's the problem with this sort of engagement in activities, and that's how our speaking and our gossiping is like a toad speaking in that sense. So now what is the solution to this? Solution is, Srila Prabhupada explained, not silence but Krishna Katha. Because we cannot stay silent for very long. Even if we try to, we will have a natural urge to speak. And if we don't dovetail that natural urge properly, and the only result will be that we'll feel ourselves suppressed. And when we suppress ourselves for too long, after time, the suppression just expresses itself in ugly ways. So we have to spiritualize our urge to speak. So when we learn to speak about Krishna, it is supremely satisfying. Because when we speak about Krishna, it purifies us, it benefits us, and similarly it purifies and benefits others. So the process of bhakti is so wonderful that whatever our bodily urges are, we are not asked to give them up. We are asked simply to sublimate them, to spiritualize them. And in fact, there is no activity more auspicious than speaking about Krishna. So every opportunity that we have to speak about Krishna, we can be grateful for that. Now that opportunity may be on the Vyasasana where we are speaking formally to people, or it may be informally speaking to one or two people. But every opportunity to speak about Krishna is taking us closer to Krishna and is helping others to come closer to Krishna. So in this way, the very tongue that normally attracts death can now attract Krishna. When Krishna sees, oh, this devotee is speaking about me, sharing my message with others, Krishna becomes pleased by that. Krishna says that one who shares my message with others, that I am very pleased with that person. I love that person and I bring that person back to me quickly. I guarantee him pure devotional service. Which tasman manishyeshu kaschin me priyakrittama bhavita tasman anya priyataro bhuvi. Krishna describes in 18.68 in the Bhagavad Gita that a person is so very dear to me, no one will be ever more dear to me than one who shares my message. So this is the wonderful power of bhakti. The very thing that was causing us bondage can now become the source of liberation for us. Then after that, after we look at vacho vegam, then let us look at manasaha vegam. So manasaha vegam means the urge of the mind. So there the problem is that we can't have a vacuum. We can't just keep our mind empty. That will attract the anarthas. The solution is to meditate on the lotus feet of Krishna. Prabhupada gives the example of sun and Krishna. The mind has to think about something. It may think about things randomly or it may think about things systematically. But thinking cannot be stopped. Speaking can be stopped for some time at least. We can be silent for some time. We can't be all the time silent. But as far as the activity is concerned, the mind is far more active than the physical senses. And it's not only its activity more, but its speed is also far greater. Thak, one thought, second thought, third thought, fourth thought. So it can think faster and move faster. The mind can move faster than the speed of light also. The light speed of light is considered to be the fastest by modern physics, but the mind can go much faster than that. So now, this manasa vega, this urge of the mind, we can't freeze the mind. Even when the mind gets caught in one object, sometimes we are attached to something, and the mind gets caught in a particular sense object. If an alcoholic is there, the person's mind is caught in that bottle of alcohol. But actually, even then, the mind is not at rest. actually the mind is caught with the bottle of alcohol, and from there it is having so many imaginations. Oh, I'll drink this, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do that. And those imaginations are also endless. So the mind in and of itself can never be inactive. So why can't it be inactive? Because its very nature is to be active. It's subtler than the gross sense. If the gross senses are active, the mind is further active, hyperactive. So the best thing that we can do for the mind is give it a safe and satisfying avenue for activity. Just like a child. We can't expect the child to stay silent. The child is by nature active. The child starts playing with the knife or starts playing with the lighter and starts turning on the fire of the gas. Then it's dangerous. So instead, what does the mother do? The mother gives the child some toys to play with. The child becomes satisfied. So like that, we can't avoid the mind being active. What we can do is give the mind a safe avenue for activity. And what is that safe avenue? That is Krishna consciousness. Srila Prabhupada gives the example that just as that Krishna Surya Sama Maya Hai Andhikar, Jahan Krishna Tahar Nahi Maya Radhikar. So it's a very interesting way of putting it. He uses the word Adhikar. Adhikar means authority. Krishna Das Gauranga Goswami is saying that wherever there is Krishna, Maya has no authority, Maya has no jurisdiction. It's an interesting phrase because the implication is twofold. One is that the converse is also true. That means wherever there is no Krishna, there is Maya's authority only. That falls under Maya's jurisdiction. And by default, material desires will be there, whether they are manifest or they are not manifest right now. So now the second point is that how does Maya's jurisdiction, Maya's control over a particular area go away? How does she withdraw from our consciousness? It's Krishna Surya Sama. When in the room light is off, at that time, if I am irritated with the darkness, I'm stumbling on something, falling on something, I'm groping around, what can I do? I cannot use my fist. You darkness, I'll punch you, get lost. I cannot curse the darkness. I cannot even use a sharp sword. I will chop you to pieces. No, it's all, these are useless. When the darkness comes, the only way to remove darkness is by gaining light, by getting light. And with all the previous efforts, that driving out darkness was impossible. But as soon as the light comes out, we don't have to do anything separately to remove the darkness. Just the bringing of the light, the darkness has to flee. Similarly, Jahan Krishna Tahar Nahi Maya Radhikar. Where there is light, darkness has no authority left over there. Similarly, when we bring Krishna, Maya has to go away. Maya can't stay on. Maya just has to be driven out. So the solution is to, when we meditate on Krishna's lotus feet, means we serve Krishna. The lotus feet represent basically service. So when we serve Krishna, by that service to Krishna, and fixing the mind in Krishna, we can drive away Maya. So this is again not mechanical. We have to absorb ourselves in Krishna. Because again, the point is that we have to fill the mind with Krishna. So if I am just uttering Hare Krishna, and all that I am doing while uttering Hare Krishna is, just my lips are speaking. But my mind is still caught up in all the parade of sense objects the mind world is presenting in front of me. Then such chanting, it's also beneficial at one level, but it's not actually transformational. It doesn't allow my mind to move from material things to Krishna. So therefore, manasaha vega, the vega of the mind, has to be controlled by directing it towards Krishna. And how do I direct it towards Krishna? That is something which each of us has to find out for ourselves. So each of us is unique, and each of us has a unique relationship with Krishna. Of course, at a pure spiritual level, the unique flavor of our relationship, our unique rasa, will be revealed when we become purified, when our swarupa becomes manifested. But even now, although our conditioning may be there, and although our spiritual uniqueness is covered over, and what we now have is material uniqueness, but still, even in this condition also, because we are unique, our disposition is distinctive. And we have to find out what is the way I become attracted to Krishna? Some of us may find that by studying philosophy, studying scripture, understanding concepts seriously, I become fixed, I become steady against strength. Some of us may find that by worshipping the deity, by going and praying, by taking darshan, by doing puja, by worshipping the deity, if you are brahmanas, then you can do personal worship. That's what gives me a lot of strength. Some others may find that by singing bhajans, I get a lot of strength. Someone else may find that by just singing the Hare Krishna Mahamantra in different tunes and dancing in kirtans, that gives me a lot of strength. Someone else may find that, okay, an association of a particular devotee gives me a lot of strength. So there is this important role of individuality in the universal process of Krishna consciousness. Although the processes are universal, but every one of us is an individual. And we have to find out which process of devotional service attracts us. In which process can we absorb ourselves more and more. And when we absorb ourselves more and more in Krishna, then Maya will go away. So often, our struggle becomes more difficult because we try to drive Maya away without finding out how we can become attracted to Krishna. See, ultimately, I am responsible for my spiritual advancement. My spiritual advancement is not Krishna's responsibility. It is not my spiritual master's responsibility. It is not my counselor's responsibility. It is my responsibility, first and foremost. Of course, it is their responsibility also. A spiritual master takes the responsibility of delivering the disciple. But that is like a doctor saying that I will take the responsibility to cure the patient. But the doctor cannot be there all the time making sure, nagging the patient. Have you taken this medicine? Have you taken this medicine? Have you taken this medicine? And the doctor says, I will take responsibility for the curing the patient. That means, doctor says, you know what? I will use all my knowledge, all my experience to recommend the best possible treatment. And if any complications take place, I will use all my abilities to make sure that I address the complications. But taking the treatment is the patient's responsibility. So in that sense, the getting cured is the patient's responsibility. Offering the facilities for the cure is the doctor's responsibility. Similarly, our spiritual advancement is primarily our responsibility. The spiritual master, like a doctor, the spiritual master provides all the facilities. He'll provide us his own association through classes and through personal association. He may provide us his senior disciples who are trained, who can inspire and guide us. He can provide us his audios. He may write books and provide books for us. He may build a beautiful community, build beautiful temples and have deities. Through that he provides facility. That's what Srila Prabhupada has done for all of us as the founder acharya of our movement. But ultimately it's our responsibility to make spiritual advancement. So once we understand that, you know, fixing the mind on Krishna, fixing my mind on Krishna is my responsibility, then we will become serious. Okay, what is the way I can fix my mind on Krishna? By doing this, by doing that, by doing that. And each of us may take devotional inventory of our own spiritual life and find out what attracts us to Krishna and then fix the mind on Krishna by that. And then we'll be able to stay steady and happy in our devotional life. Then manasa vegam, then krodha vegam. So krodha vegam is the urge for anger. So actually, Prabhupada says the problem is that anger can't be stopped. And the solution is to apply against blasphemers. Prabhupada gives the examples of Jagai, Madai, Hanuman and Arjuna. So among all the six anarthas that are there, lust, anger, greed, envy, pride and illusion, probably the one anartha that almost everyone agrees is bad is anger. And lust, materialistic people think that it's good. You know, the more lust there is, we will enjoy. Of course, they also have some limits. Materialistic people feel that sex should be consensual, it should not be forcible, whatever. But they think lust is good. Similarly, greed, people think people may decorate greed by the title ambition. They have to be ambitious. But anger is something which almost everybody agrees is bad. Because often anger makes us do things that make a problem, that create a bigger problem than the original problem. Somebody has done something wrong and I speak such things in a fit of anger, it breaks that person's heart. So first, whatever the thing that was in that got broken, and then the person's heart got broken. So the problem becomes worse. So therefore, anger is something which can be quite detrimental, and it's very dangerous also at times. And especially when we are a devotee association, when we commit offenses by in a fit of anger, that can be very dangerous. Of course, if we have deep-rooted malicious intentions, if we somehow are envious of devotees and we want to put them down, and because of that we speak wrong things, that is much worse. But if in the heat of the moment, sometimes you just speak something because you wanted to do some service and you're not able to do that because of the negligence of some devotee, then that is excusable. That should not be repeated, but that is not a serious offense. Because offense primarily means that we have a harm-causing mentality towards others. So, now what do we do with our anger? Actually, it can be expressed in devotional service, but in a very regulated way. Srila Prabhupada normally gives these three examples, but if you think about all the devotional literature that is there, there are not many examples like this. And the important point is that rather than focusing on how I can use anger, we should focus on how I can control anger. Because there is a very thin dividing line between whether I am using anger in Krishna's service or anger is using me in Maya's service. How do we know the difference? Whether I am using anger in Krishna's service or anger is using me in Maya's service. Actually, it will depend on two things. One is the motivation, and the second is the effect. The effect in turn will depend on the nature of the relationship and the situation in which we became angry. So first and foremost is, you know, if I become, many times when some things go wrong, our anger is not so much because, oh, some service to Krishna got disrupted. Our anger is because I was doing you this service and now my good name will be spoiled. What will people think about me? So when we are more in a mood of preserving our own name, and then we burst out at others, then the Krishna element is very less. So in general, it is good for devotees to avoid anger. Hanumanji did become angry when Lord Rama was blasphemed. But at the end of it, we see in Lanka, Hanuman started lamenting. What did I do? And in a fit of anger, I just burned Lanka. And he looks around, he sees almost the whole of Lanka is ablaze. At least the area where everything is ablaze. And he thinks, Sita also got burnt. What did I do? What was I thinking? I just got in a fit of rage. And the whole purpose for which I came has been defeated because of my rashness. And he starts goading himself for that. And at that time, a divine voice comes. He's told, well, Sita is fully safe. And then he feels relief. But still, at that time, he speaks that anger is very dangerous. One has to be very careful about getting angry. So in general, if our motivation is not pure, then the anger can be very counterproductive. And beyond that, consequence. Sometimes I may say my motivation is pure, but that doesn't mean that the other person can take the anger. The other person may still become devastated by that. And that person's spiritual life may get shattered or morale may get shattered. So you have to be extremely careful with getting angry. Srila Prabhupada sometimes gives the example that a person can show fangs but not bite. There's the story of Narad Muni who preached to a snake and the snake became a devotee. And the snake after that stopped biting people. But then when he stopped biting people, others started beating him up. So then Narad Muni came and saw that the snake was injured. And the snake told this predicament. So Narad Muni said, yes, I told don't bite others. But that doesn't mean you can't show your fangs. You can show your fangs. That means, the point is, that sometimes we have to speak assertively so that people take us seriously. Otherwise, if you are always kind and gentle, it may happen, kind and gentle and sweet, then people may start exploiting us, pushing us around, not taking us seriously and doing all sorts of things with us, which are basically exploitative. So at that time, we have to take a firm stand. So taking a firm stand is not becoming angry. Because when we take a firm stand, it is we who are in control. When we become angry, it is anger that is in control. So when anger comes in control, that means when we are speaking something, we lose awareness of what we are speaking. And we just blast out things, and then after somebody gave us a tape recorder of what we spoke, and we hear it, we'll be horrified. I spoke all those things. How could I speak all those things? So, if we lose control of ourselves while we are speaking, then it's most likely that it is not that we are using anger in Krishna's service. It is Maya who is using us, or it is anger who is using us in Maya's service. Therefore, for us as devotees, we should make it a principle in general that I will not become angry. Because for us at the sadhaka stage to experience spiritual anger is difficult. It will just be material anger at our stage. Material anger can be very, very damaging for our spiritual life in terms of our relationships. And so when we meditate on Krishna's lotus feet, we can blaspheme, we can direct it against blasphemers. What does it mean to direct anger against blasphemers? That doesn't mean that wherever we see a blasphemer, we just go and start speaking all sorts of abusive words to the blasphemer. Not at all. Directing the anger to the blasphemers means that we, in an intelligent way, refute their misconceptions. So again, even while dealing with atheists, dealing with blasphemers, we have to be in control. We have to be aware of what we are doing and act accordingly. The Bhagavatam gives the example of Daksha, of the Yajna of Daksha. And basically, there were just curses and counter-curses, and the whole Yajna became an assembly of devastation. So it all started with Daksha having overestimation of his own position. And so when Shiva didn't offer obeisances, he considered that as a put down. And then he spoke a lot negatively about Shiva. And then after that, Shiva went away. And then Shiva's wife Parvati came, and Parvati was disrespected. And when Parvati was disrespected, then she committed suicide. And then Shiva got angry. He sent Veerabhadra. And Veerabhadra killed everyone over there, destroyed everything over there, all the sacrifice, and then killed Daksha Prajapati. And manhandled many of the sages also over there, priests rather, who were performing sacrifices. So all this was later, huge complications. And Brahmaji personally had to go to Lord Shiva's abode and pacify him. But even before that, there was counter-cursing and counter-cursing. And the Daksha Prajapati cursed Shiva, and Shiva's followers cursed the Brahmins cursed Shiva's followers. And what happened? Now the point is not whether the anger was justified or not. The point is whether the consequence was right or not. The consequence became undesirable. Now the followers of Shiva were right in saying that, oh, actually, our spiritual masters blaspheme. We have to counter. Yes, we have to counter. Now, you know, every devotional principle is integrated in the framework of other devotional principles. We cannot take one principle in isolation and apply it. See, ultimately, the most important devotional principle is that we remember Krishna and we help others to remember Krishna. And all other devotional principles are subordinate to that. So, Smartavya Satam Vishnu, Smartavana Jatuchit, Sarva Vidhi Nishedasur, Etayor Eva Kinkaram. That all rules and regulations are subordinate to this one principle that we should always remember Krishna. Now, if I take this rule that we should not hear the blasphemy of our spiritual master, that's true. But in the name of responding to the blasphemy, I could make the situation worse. And when I make the situation worse, then there are curses and counter-curses, and there are further complications, and there is conflicts and conflagrations and violence. Then have I really served the purpose? It's not that we should be afraid of conflicts and confrontations. But the point is, our goal should be ourselves go closer to Krishna and help others go closer to Krishna. We can't isolate any rule from the overall framework of rules that are given. Overall scriptural framework that is given. And the primary scriptural rule is that we should always remember Krishna. So we should always react to all situations, including blasphemy, in a way that is anukul to our remembrance of Krishna. So when we direct our anger against atheists, that means that we use the passion, even the anger, we could say, for systematically and thoroughly refuting their misconceptions. So we use logic, argument. See, anger can energize us. But rather than letting that energy go out of control, rather than letting that energy take control of us, we channelize that energy so that we vigorously, even vehemently, audaciously refute the misconceptions. And that way, we will check the arrogance of the atheists and the blasphemers. And those who are waverers, who are sitting on the fence, they will see, okay, these people, what they say makes sense. And they will come towards Krishna. So our goal is to remember Krishna ourselves and to help others come close to Krishna. So atheists may not come close to Krishna, but at least those who are under atheistic influence, those who may get affected by atheists, they can come towards Krishna by our sharing of Krishna consciousness in a vigorous way. So in this way, the urge for anger needs to be controlled and then channelized as vigor and even vehemence, we could say, in our efforts to reach out, to share Krishna consciousness with others. This is how Vacho Manasa Krodha Vegam can be regulated. Thank you. We'll continue the remaining Vegas in our next class. Hare Krishna.